It is 6 p.m. Stay tuned for the KPFA Weekend News.
Good evening. It's Sunday, April 11th. President Barack Obama says he's pleased about the sense of urgency among nearly 50 nations taking part tomorrow in a Washington, D.C.-based summit on global nuclear security. It will be the largest assembly of world leaders hosted by a U.S. president since the 1945 San Francisco conference that founded the United Nations.
Human rights groups in Israel warn that new orders from the Israeli military could lead to the expulsion of tens of thousands of Palestinians.
Hundreds demonstrate in Los Angeles to demand equal social security benefits for same-sex couples. Representative Linda Sanchez, a Democrat, told the demonstrators she'd author legislation to introduce benefits to gay and lesbian couples.
And thousands of Bay Area residents spend the weekend at the San Francisco's annual Green Festival, where they learn about environmental topics such as solar energy, composting, and urban gardens. I'm Vanessa Brookhaveny.
And I'm Vanessa Tate, and this is the KPFA Weekend News. U.S. President Barack Obama said today he was pleased about the sense of urgency among nearly 50 countries taking part in a Washington, D.C. summit over efforts to lock down loose nuclear material. Obama, speaking before the start of the two-day summit tomorrow, said that the single biggest threat to U.S. security was the risk of a terrorist organization obtaining a nuclear weapon. Obama has set a goal of ensuring all nuclear materials worldwide are secured from theft or diversion within 4 years. On the table, too, will be Iran's perceived attempts to build a nuclear weapon in violation of the Global Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, and North Korea's nuclear weapons stockpile and exports of nuclear materials. Neither country was invited to the summit. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton spoke on ABC's This Week.
Well, part of the goal of the Nuclear Security Summit is to focus on the threat from nuclear terrorism. And we don't believe the threat from nuclear terrorism comes from states. Our biggest concern is that terrorists will get nuclear material. We fear North Korea and Iran because their behavior, as in the first case, to North Korea being already having nuclear weapons and Iran seeking them, is that they are unpredictable. They have an attitude toward countries like Israel, like their other neighbors in the Gulf, that makes them a danger. So we are focusing on the two states, but we are also very concerned about nuclear material falling into terrorist hands, and that's a concern that we all share.
Clinton said the gathering would be the largest assembly of world leaders hosted by a U.S. president since the 1945 San Francisco conference that founded the United Nations. Greg Mello is executive director of the Los Alamos Study Group. He's worried that the summit is being used mainly as a foreign policy weapon against Iran.
What I hope comes out of this meeting is a greater sense of responsibility by the nuclear weapons states, and especially by the United States, for their own nuclear intransigence. We have disarmament obligations, and we are not fulfilling them. What I don't want to come out of this meeting is a consensus that we need to impose hard sanctions on Iran. I don't want Iran to be scapegoated or for the United States to slip farther toward war. It's very clear that the United States wants to use the non-proliferation issue as a vehicle for the unfettered application of all forms of U.S. power.
The nuclear summit comes on the heels of a newly signed Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, or START Treaty, between the U.S. and Russia that reduces each side's deployed nuclear arsenal to 1,550 weapons. Earlier in the week, President Obama approved a new nuclear policy for the U.S., vowing to reduce America's nuclear arsenal, refrain from nuclear testing, and not use nuclear weapons against countries that do not have them. But Greg Mello says while anti-nuclear activists are supportive of Obama's efforts to get highly enriched uranium secured, they are skeptical about the administration's rhetoric matching reality.
People need to realize that President Obama has requested more than $600 million in additional nuclear weapons spending for the coming year alone, and that is supposed to increase to double that much in the coming years after that. Finance that, he's gotten a subsidy from Pentagon funds, probably from the Air Force. I haven't looked. This is one of the largest increases in nuclear weapons spending history. And at Los Alamos Lab, with which I am most familiar, it is the largest increase since the Manhattan Project. So we are, in effect, beginning the Manhattan Project again. The centerpiece of the spending at Los Alamos is a giant plutonium complex, a new kind of bunker that will be placed on the bottom of it 125 feet below the surface of the ground, involving 355,000 cubic yards of concrete. This is to partially replace the Rocky Flats plant near Denver. And the purpose of it is to make the new warheads, which Obama claims he doesn't want to make. It has no other coherent purpose. People need to realize that there are enough exceptions in Obama's promise not to make new warheads to drive a Minuteman missile through. This stuff is very real on the ground. When you get out to the nuclear weapons complex, out to New Mexico, let's say, this would be the largest public works project in New Mexico by a factor of 10 in its entire history.
That was Greg Mello, executive director of the Los Alamos Study Group.
Human rights groups in Israel are warning that some new orders from the Israeli military could lead to the expulsion of tens of thousands of Palestinians from the West Bank. They're calling on Israeli officials to rescind the orders. Under the new rules, anyone caught living in the West Bank without an Israeli permit could face expulsion in as little as 3 days or be sentenced to up to 7 years in prison. Richard Falk is the UN Special Reporter on Human Rights in the occupied West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip.
I think this represents a very serious development that threatens the security and the stability of the whole occupation regime, that is a serious menace to the well-being of the Palestinian people to begin with.
The military says it can already expel illegal residents under existing law, and that this is just another level of judicial oversight. But the Israeli human rights groups say the orders are so vague and so sweeping that virtually all West Bankers could be at risk. Again, Richard Falk.
This seems to be a significant escalation of the oppressive character of the occupation, because it creates the potential to deprive every Palestinian living in the West Bank of their capacity to maintain their residence there.
The military later clarified the orders to say that people with residency rights won't be targeted. Still, the chief Palestinian negotiator denounced the new measures as, quote, an assault on ordinary Palestinians. He says they're being turned into criminals in their own homes. Evacuations could begin as early as Tuesday. In related news, the award-winning documentary Checkpoint will be playing this Friday at 7 p.m. Initiated by Holocaust survivor Dr. Annette Herskovitz, the film documents checkpoints throughout the West Bank, capturing the distress of Palestinians waiting to pass through. The event will be held at the Berkeley Fellowship of Unitarian Universalists and is free. Donations will benefit the Palestine Children's Relief Fund.
In Honduras, an incident that is being portrayed as a shootout between rival street gangs battling for control of the drug trade killed 9 people in the capital of Tegucigalpa overnight, an official said today. Gang members wearing police uniforms and ski masks, according to the official, burst into a house in a crime-plagued area on the outskirts of Tegucigalpa and began shooting. The country's deputy security minister said people inside returned fire and 7 men and 2 women were killed. But Dana Frank, a professor of history at the University of California, Santa Cruz, says there's a reason to question the government's story. Assassinations of activists resisting the coup government of Pepe Lobo have been carried out recently under the cover of so-called gang violence.
Last night there was a gang fight, alleged gang fight, between 2 gangs in Tegucigalpa, and I think it's 9 gang members were killed. And this is what has been reported in the papers, but the Honduran newspapers famously lie like a rug. So it's very unclear what actually happened. It's very possible it was a real gang fight because the gangs are vicious and brutal and very powerful. But it's also possibly part of the same terror campaign to make ordinary Hondurans think that they should accept this much more terrifying coup regime, military state repression.
Frank says another serious situation is developing for a group of campesinos or farmers who have been occupying some land since December in protest of the coup. Human rights advocates fear for the safety of the protesters, says Frank.
Since December 15, 3,500 campesino families organized in 7 collectives have been occupying some African palm plantation land that Miguel Facuse, one of the richest people in the country, if not the richest, and one of the top leaders behind the coup, has claimed this land for some years. And these campesinos are claiming it for themselves in the absence of any agrarian reform in the country. They've been there since December 15th. Pepe Lobo, the new president, has announced that he's going to wipe them out if it takes the whole army to do it. He said that recently to delegates from the campesinos who are asking for agrarian reform. And we've been having reports for some weeks now about paramilitaries surrounding these campesinos who are occupying the land. It's a really scary, volatile situation. And Billy Hoya, who is head of Battalion 316, the 1980s death squads, has been seen in the area. And in the last 2 days, on Friday and Saturday, what is now looking like over 20 truckloads of the Army soldiers have been seen entering the area. And we're very, very concerned there's going to be a massacre at any moment. It's very important to people to call the State Department, call your congressperson, immediately call the media and say, please alert people to the danger of this imminent massacre. It's not being reported in the mainstream media at all that this situation, and it's very terrifying. On Friday, all the newspapers in the country, the private and public, except the opposition newspapers and media, radio and television, all carried the same warning from coup regime president Pepe Lobo, saying that there was all these people out armed that have arms out there, and any private holding of arms is illegal, including AK-47s. And this is sort of to alert, this is sort of a scare tactic to make the Honduran people think that somehow there's about to be guerrilla activity going on out there in the Aguan Valley. So the opposition has been very clear that this is part of laying the ground for claiming that the nonviolent people in the cooperative, the acronym is MUCA, in the Aguan Valley are somehow a guerrilla movement in that area and justifying a massacre.
That was Dana Frank, a professor of history at the University of California, Santa Cruz, who has published extensively on Honduras. You are listening to the KPFA News broadcast here on 94.1 FM each day at 6 p.m. with Vanessa Brooke Caveney. I'm Vanessa Tate. Still to come, Thailand's pro-democracy protesters recoup. Thailand Maryland's pro-democracy red shirt protesters ruled out negotiations with the government today and said they would not give up their fight for early elections a day after clashes with security forces killed 21 people and injured hundreds. Bangkok was quiet, but with no resolution in sight. The red shirts, mostly rural and working class supporters of ex-premier Thaksin Shinawatra, who was ousted in a coup in 2006, want parliament dissolved and the current prime minister to leave the country. Yesterday's fighting, the worst political violence in the country since 1992, ended after security forces pulled back late in the night. The red shirts, still numbering in the thousands, have occupied two main areas of the capital, a city of 15 million that has been under a state of emergency since Wednesday. They made no attempt to come out of their bases today, and troops did not make any move towards them. Thaksin, writing on his Twitter account, accused the government of bringing troops from all over the country to crush the protests. Government spokespeople vowed to return order to the streets, although they conceded that troops would not be able to take control immediately after the damage suffered in yesterday's clashes.
The San Francisco Spring Green Festival took place this weekend and gave attendees a glimpse of what a truly green economy might look like. 350 eco-friendly businesses exhibited everything from body care products to home building materials made of renewable resources. Advertised as the largest sustainability event in the world, the festival featured a host of speakers and workshops to, quote, celebrate what's working in our communities. Speakers included Alice Walker, Amy Goodman, and Chuck D. One of the movements showcased that seems to be gaining popularity is that of urban gardening. Several exhibitors offered products that allow folks to grow their own food, even without access to a backyard. Filmmaker Carl Grether has documented this phenomena in the Bay Area in his upcoming feature titled Edible City.
It's basically focusing on what's happening within the city around food. So again, that started with urban gardening. So that was backyard gardens, community gardens. But then from there, it snowballed, and we realized the movement is much bigger than that. Urban farming was just the tip of the iceberg as far as educating people, sharing food, community-supported kitchens, food policy councils springing up in Oakland and Berkeley and San Francisco. It's really this exciting transformation that is happening very quickly here in the Bay Area, and I think it's beginning to spread to the rest of the country, and we're really exploring it from the sort of the grassroots, backyard, urban farmer level, up through the educators and the community organizers, all the way up to, you know, city policy, state policy, and eventually federal policy. I would recommend to everybody, start growing your own food, because it'll change your life in amazing ways.
Edible City is slated to come out this fall. Folks can find more information at ediblecitymovie.com. I also spoke with Kip Anderson of Super Closet, which offers a product that looks like a handsome wood cabinet from the outside, but actually contains a lit hydroponic growing system on the inside.
What we make is fully contained cabinets where you open up your cabinet and it's a complete environmental growing chamber system, hydroponics, where all you do is put your plants in, plug the system in, and it grows plants by itself. You just fill it up with hydroponic nutrients. So it's a nice, really nice powder-coated black cabinet that fits in with your furniture. But right here there's thyme, basil, cilantro, Roma tomatoes, big tomatoes, hot peppers, green peppers. We're doing phenomenal as a business. It's just growing ever more because it's all about relationship to your food and what you put in your body. Our website's supercloset.com.
If you're more inclined to work with dirt, others offered outdoor solutions to growing your own food.
My name is Julie Jackson, and the business is called Vertical Home Garden. We're Oakland-based, and we manufacture and sell containers for personal green production. And a PhytoPot comes in three sizes, a small, medium, and a large, and you can grow from 10 to 15 to 20 square feet of all kinds of plants on it. And it's suitable, as I mentioned before, for a balcony, a rooftop, or anyone that doesn't have a yard. And it's sort of like a new way of urban living. So on a small PhytoPod, which is 10 square feet, you can get about 60 heads of lettuce.
More information on the PhytoPod can be found at verticalhomegardens.com or by calling 510-599-5847.
About 175 nations agreed on a plan today to revive climate talks after the fractious Copenhagen summit in December. But the United Nations top climate official predicted A full treaty was out of reach for 2010. Delegates at the talks, which reopened splits between rich and poor nations from Copenhagen, agreed to hold two extra meetings, each at least a week long, in the second half of 2010 after the December summit fell short of a binding deal. The extra sessions and a linked agreement to prepare new texts about fighting climate change are meant to help pave the way to the next annual meeting of environment ministers in Cancun, Mexico, in late November. And the UN's top climate official said governments should focus on practical steps this year, such as aid to help poor nations cope with the impact of climate change or to promote clean technologies. It was not decided where and when the extra meetings would be held. They will be in addition to a session in Bonn in late May. The UN talks among senior officials were meant to build trust after the December summit nearly agreed the non-binding Copenhagen Accord, which has backing from about 120 of 194 UN member nations, including all the top greenhouse gas emitters.
Poland's government is moving swiftly to show that it is staying on course after the weekend plane crash that killed the country's president and dozens of political, military, and religious leaders. A government spokesperson says new acting chiefs of the military are already in place, and an interim director of the country's central bank has been named. Meanwhile, tens of thousands of Poles have been showing their grief. They softly sang the national anthem and tossed flowers at the hearse carrying the body of Lech Kaczynski to the presidential palace after it was flown back to Poland from an airport near the crash site in Russia.
Protesters chanting slogans and carrying signs marched in Hollywood to demand equal security, social security benefits for same-sex couples today. Lori Jean of the Los Angeles Gay and Lesbian Center says about 700 peaceful demonstrators walked more than a mile today to the Hollywood Social Security Administration office. Before the march, senior Alice Herman spoke about being denied benefits after the death of her wife, saying the situation for same-sex couples has to change. Representative Linda Sanchez, a Democrat, told the cheering crowd she would author legislation that would extend benefits to older gay and lesbian couples. Representative Judy Chu offered to co-author the bill, and Senator Barbara Boxer also spoke. Tomorrow on KPFA's Women's Magazine, in observance of Administrative Professionals Day, also known as National Secretaries Day, Kate Raphael talks with office workers fighting for union recognition at Hastings College of Law, and with Linda Bloom, author of Between Feminism and Labor, The Significance of the Comparable Worth Movement. That's tomorrow, Monday, at 1 p.m. here on KPFA 94.1 FM.
A cluster of moderate earthquakes near the Mexico border has rattled southern San Diego County as seismic activity continues a week after a magnitude 7.2 quake struck the area. The U.S. Geological Survey says a magnitude 4.4 earthquake struck this morning about 11 miles west of downtown Calexico. At least 17 other quakes in the magnitude 3 range were reported in the same area.
Bolivian President Evo Morales has accused the opposition of electoral fraud after losing ground in last Sunday's regional elections. Morales says the four eastern provinces where his opposition is based are guilty of toying with democracy.
Comportamiento.
The behavior of the electoral counts in Pando, Santa Cruz, Tarija, and Ben is criminal. For now, our job is to defend people's vote. Later, we'll take legal action against these authorities that are toying with democracy.
In the eastern province of Pando, exit polls showed a close tie before Morales claimed a victory for his party. On Monday, police guarded the electoral count while mass supporters demanded a revote. As protesters threw explosives, police with ballot boxes entered the court to count the vote again. Initially, the courts had denied Morales' charge of fraud. Meanwhile, the opposition says the pro-government MAS party is also guilty of election fraud, charging that Morales replaced names of candidates with MAS allies without notifying voters. Opposition Senator Carmen Evo Gonzalez accused the ruling party of trucking voters into Pando to win votes.
Once the electoral fraud in Pando has been proven, there must be new elections, but with all the precautions needed to avoid the same mistakes and errors. There must be international observers. The fraud in Pando was carried out by MAS each time they took big groups of people to the province to vote.
Official results have still not been announced, but Bolivian news outlets have called the vote for the MAS party in a majority of 9 districts. In 6 of 10 major cities, however, the opposition seems poised to win mayoral seats.
The centuries-old tradition of underage marriage continues today across India, including the western state of Rajasthan. Although child marriage was banned across the country in 1923, the state government of Rajasthan has now decided to register all marriages, including weddings of children. Opponents say the registration of these officially illegal unions will only serve to implicitly encourage them. Jasvinder Sehgal reports from Jaipur, India.
In the rural Tonk district of Rajasthan, a group of women gather and sing a folk song to commemorate a wedding. The groom is a 14-year-old boy and the bride a 9-year-old girl. This marriage is illegal under Indian law, which states that the minimum age for a bride is 18 years old and for a groom, 21. Child marriages are expected to increase in May, coinciding with the day of Akha Tej, when the sun and moon are believed to be at their most benign positions. During this period, hundreds of infant brides and grooms, some as young as 2, will be married off. Amidst the centuries-old practice of child marriage of Rajasthan, the state government has introduced a new law to register all marriages, including those of children. The new law seeks registration of all marriages and says the couple or their parents, in cases where they are under 21, are responsible for registering the marriage within 30 days. Kavita Srivastava is an activist who opposes the law. She says it contradicts the original marriage registration law and will encourage families to push more children into marriage.
All marriages that are solemnized will be registered. So all of us know that child marriages happen. So this is one gateway of somewhere legitimizing child marriages. Once the children who got married as when they were kids grow to 18 and 21, they can get that marriage registered. So this is the contradiction.
A United Nations report found that more than a third of the world's child brides are from India, and many of them were married before they turned 10. According to another study conducted by the Population Council of India, about half of Indian women were married before they were 18, while one-fifth of them were married before they were 15. Sunita Sompara, a tribal widow of Dungarpur, was married when she was just 6 years old.
I got married at a very early age. I also gave birth to children at a young age. Because of a disease, my husband died, leaving me all alone. Because of my early marriage, I could not complete my studies, and I'm in deep trouble now. I cannot prosper in my life ever.
In India, the child marriage traditions are difficult to break amongst the poverty-ridden tribal and rural societies. Sompura says she strongly opposes the tradition of child marriage.
The practice of child marriages should be discontinued. The marriages solemnized at a tender age are harmful not only for the girl, but for the family and children too.
The Home Minister of Rajasthan says the government doesn't endorse child marriages, but registering them is important so that the children are counted as legitimate and have inheritance rights in case of the death of either parent. Jaswinder Sehgal, FSRN, Jaipur, India.
And for the weather in the San Francisco Bay Area tonight, showers with highs in the upper 40s, coastside to the 50s inland. Tomorrow, showers with isolated thunderstorms with hail, lows in the upper 40s, coastside to the 50s inland. In Fresno and the San Joaquin Valley tonight, rain, thunderstorms after midnight, lows from 43 to 48. And tomorrow, showers likely with scattered thunderstorms in the afternoon, highs from 58 to 64. That's it for tonight's news. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to Glenn Reeder for his help tonight. Kelly Ramirez produced recorded portions. Lynn Haug is at the controls. With Vanessa Brooke Caveney, I'm Vanessa Tate. Good evening.
KPFA at 61 has been here, there, and everywhere. And KPFA is taking